Hi, Chief Halton here at Fire Engineering Podcasts, and we are being brought to you by Tenkata Protective Fabrics and their Made for Life podcast hosted by Stuart Perry. The Made for Life podcast unearths the work experiences of real men and women who rely on the protective clothing and equipment to get the job done. From firefighters to industrial workers to military personnel, recent episodes explore the dangers and challenges of wildland firefighting, peer counseling for first responders, and the ins and outs of turnout gear. It's the Made for Life podcast from Tenkata Fabrics. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And thank you for listening to Fire Engineering.
Thanks for tuning in to Fire Engineering Talk Radio. Each week, our host will introduce you to a various cast of characters you will only find here. Each host will share experience, knowledge, and expertise regarding their years in the fire service, allowing you to call in and speak with them live, an experience you can only find on Fire Engineering Talk Radio. So thanks for joining us. Enjoy and stay safe.
Welcome to another edition of Fire and Training. I'm your host, Douglas Klein, and we have a unique, to say the least, show tonight. We're going to be talking about some things that are probably not common around your kitchen table. And, you know, the biggest thing about Fire and Training is we're dedicated to the men and women who are in our streets working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, from the largest of metro departments to the smallest of rural departments, taking care of their communities. We want to provide them the best education and knowledge that we possibly can. That's what the show's about, and we're dedicated to everyone going home. So on tonight's show, I have a unique guest lined up, a gentleman that I met this year at FDIC, enjoyed having conversation and dialogue about what his expertise is and the message that he's bringing to folks and to raise the awareness about construction site emergencies. And, you know, joining me on tonight's show is Mike Wallingford. He's been a firefighter for 26 years and is a career captain with the Jefferson Town Fire and EMS in the Louisville, Kentucky area. He's also an environmental safety and health coordinator for a large construction company and a paving company, which has over 500 employees in the greater metropolitan area of Louisville and Kentucky. So Mike did a great program out at FDIC on construction site emergencies. And, Mike, it's great to have you on the show. I can't wait to dive in. Welcome to Fire and Training.
Thanks, Doug. I greatly appreciate the opportunity to get on and talk a little bit more about something that's just a little bit different.
Well, a little bit different it may be. However, it's in everybody's back door. It's in everybody's backyard. It's in everybody's response district when we talk about construction site emergencies. And some of the areas experiencing the growth, such as what I am in my jurisdiction here in Horry County, South Carolina, and I know the growth and activity that's going on in the Louisville area that you're around, and across the United States and you know, across the world, the amount of construction sites are greatly increasing. The thing that we think about when we think about construction site emergencies is, oh, this is going to take a technical rescue team. This is going to do this. You know, we might have to have, you know, these special response units. But here's the bottom line. Somewhere out there on the streets, somewhere out there in the department is going to be the first new engine company and the first new truck companies that are going to be arriving on scene, and they have to begin doing the mitigation or setup for the things that need to be going on. And that's where the rubber begins meeting the road for the safety of our personnel that are out in the streets that are taking care of the business that we are. Because in reality, America's Fire Service now is definitely a hazard mitigation response team, to say the least. So I'm going to kick it over to you, Mike. I know that you're very passionate about this topic, and this is an area that we fail to probably address as organizations. at the level with, that we really need to. So hopefully tonight our listeners will be able to take away some great information. If you are listening in as a guest and you want to call in and join our conversation and dialogue, or you have a question for Mike, feel free to call in. That number is 760-454-8852. Once you connect, hit 1, it'll get you in the host queue. Again, that number is 760-454-8852. Press 1 to get in the host queue. So, Mike, I'm going to kick it over to you, and I'm going to let you kind of start us off with some of your thought process about construction site emergencies.
Absolutely, Doug. Thanks again, man. I really appreciate the opportunity. In the fire service, one of the things that I always say, the first thing we do, one of the biggest things we do is when we think about construction, everybody always talks about doing a pre-plan or doing a target hazard survey. And sure, that's whenever the structure is complete and people are ready to move in. But the majority of the risk and hazards for us as responding units is truly happening before that building's ever, before the first brick or blocks even really laid, because of all of the different activities that go on throughout that construction process. I've had the great pleasure of being in environmental health and safety for about the past 15 years. And unfortunately have seen some terrible things happen. And the majority of the times that these kind of things happen, I always try to think back as, you know, when I go over to that company officer side and I start thinking about, you know, focusing more on crews that aren't filled with technical rescue trained individuals. And it's not just about big city fire department. There's plenty of small town fire departments and fire departments that, you know, we all struggle throughout the United States. So, you know, equipment can be an issue. It's definitely something that I, working in the construction industry, have really seen a need. And it's more about trying to train that first in engine company, that first in truck company. Whether they've got 2 people to 4 people to 6 people, it doesn't really matter. If you don't have the technical expertise to get a job completely done, there's still some things that need to get started. But one of the first things is really just making people aware of what's going on in a construction site. When I talked about those hazards, you know, the trenching and excavation that goes on in a job site, and I know you prefaced that, have a company that has over 500 employees, and about 80% of what my crews are doing every day is trenching and so it's a hazard that, believe me, if it's that large in my community, I know that it's there's plenty of it out across the rest of the U.S. and these people are going to deal with it. So what I did was I designed a class, and I was fortunate enough as you know to have that opportunity to really share with other individuals at FDIC, which was a phenomenal experience, but I'm trying to educate people on what does a good trench look like, or what are the things you really need to look out for. It doesn't have to be a guy that's ready to go take a trench rescue class, but it's definitely somebody that's riding around on their rigs, out and about in their district, and they see construction going on. I want people to feel comfortable enough to pull in and just say, "Hey, how's it going, guys?" And really take a look so that they better understand. And if they see something that's not right, I want them to ask. I want them to feel comfortable enough and educated enough to ask some questions. That's how we're going to drive down these construction deaths that happen typically anywhere from 50 to 70 per year. And that's really just the tip of the iceberg for the education portion of it that I've really seen kind of missing in the fire service.
Well, you're bringing out a bunch of good points here, and I'm gonna start driving home to our listeners right off the bat. On most of these construction sites, especially if you're dealing with a commercial build and you've got trenching, automatically there's a trench that's there. You have to deal with, you know, the potential collapse of a trench. You have to deal with the hazardous atmospheres that could be in that trench. Most often when they're doing a lot of these buildings and the design features as they're beginning to really start to take shape, there's a possibility for some confined spaces that we can get folks into. Automatically, there's the growth that is, it begins to go multiple levels, that the high angle aspect that goes with that, and prior to getting to that point, the low angle rescues that go about, the limited access that go to floors, you know, the amount of materials that are being moved around, specifically with the design features of when you're pouring columns and things like that out of concrete. When you're doing footers and stuff in trenches, there's so much that's there that is important for our companies that are arriving on scene, especially that are not, quote-unquote, technologically trained in all the aspects of technical rescue, all the technology that goes with that, you know, the various things that have to happen. That, and you use the word awareness. Is really key, and when we start looking at it, most fire departments don't think this way, but there is an OSHA component that goes with that, that falls back to the general duty clause in OSHA that's going to refer back to industry standards. Well, in industry standards, there's the 1006 standard in NFPA that talks about technical rescue and all the things that, you know, are associated with that. So, you know, let's take a couple of these topics and talk about it. Let's talk about how dangerous some of this trenching is, Mike, especially on some of these bigger construction sites that are starting to show up, just simply because of how they build the foundation and, you know, just some of the soil types that are going to be challenging from the various locations across our country and across the world.
You know what, you bring up a great point, Doug, when you talk about, you said soil types, and honestly, that's one of the first things that I kind of talk about, because let's face it, during a trench rescue class, the main focus of a trench rescue class is to teach you how to respond to and be able to, you know, actually retrieve someone or recover, whatever the case may be, from a trench that has collapsed. Well, I think we're missing a small point of that, and what that is actually the soil types that are out there, and actually educating our first responders on what a soil type is, on what a good trench is, and when we reach a soil type, what type of protective system, and I can, you know, we can literally talk about these for days, but when we break that down, typically most of your trenches that are done are anywhere from 6 to 8 feet. And the reason for that is where you will find the majority of your utilities. So whenever a construction company comes in and it's time to get started on it, they may be working with a blank slate. So what used to be a large field, or it ends up being something where something previously stood, all new utilities have to be laid there. So whether that's a storm sewer or a sanitary sewer or the water lines, or even getting ready to lay the conduit for the electric, 6 to 8 feet is typical. These people are dealing with, you know, three different types of soil. You've either got A, B, or C. In my organization, we don't recognize A type A soil. I just tell my guys, because there's so many things that make it not type A, I would just assume not. So we type B be the best my guys would ever get, and it all boils down to the cohesiveness of it. So you can really get in depth as far as how deep you can go into soil typing, but that's with construction companies across the U.S. It's one of the things that's also missing on their end. And that's education. When I get new employees, one of the first things I ever ask them, it's like, hey, have you ever felt like you were in a dangerous trench? And more the times than not, I get yes. And I always ask them, I said, so why'd you do it? And the majority of the time, the answer is, well, I didn't know any better. And unfortunately, in the fire service, that's exactly what we're going to get. We all know that we're wired to help people. That's just what we do. And are there times that we put ourselves in a situation where we're likely in just as much or if not more danger than the individuals we're trying to help? And that unfortunately is going to happen when referencing a trench collapse. We put ourselves into situations, especially if we're not educated. I'm not talking about sitting down through a college course. I'm talking about just going through some really bare minimum basics to give you reference points to know when, hey, if this looks good, this is okay, or these are the kind of things that we need to do. Do we need to stop all of this equipment that's running around here because of the vibration? Is that going to make things worse? Can we see some cracking in a sidewall that is honestly going to cause a secondary collapse and we're putting ourselves in danger? So it's trenching's a deep subject. I hate to kind of say it that way, but it truly is. And it's happening everywhere, no matter where your fire district is, it's happening everywhere. If it's a residential home, it's happening. If it's a commercial building, it's happening. If it's apartment complexes, it's happening. So for us to think that those kind of things only happen in big cities or those kind of things only happen places that that they have technical response is we're totally wrong. We're totally wrong. And I know every department can't afford, let's face it, can't afford to have all of the technical rescue equipment it would take to make a trench rescue or recovery, whatever it may be. Not to mention, you look at a status of manpower. These are anytime you have an incident, something of that nature. I mean, that's backbreaking work. The course that I do is just kind of I try to focus on setting up mutual aid agreements, talking to other construction companies about what they could offer you. So I think we're really trying to build some better relationships between emergency responders and construction companies before something happens. It's just a big focus.
And, you know, just talking about trenches or just the site alone, you know, we talk about the soil. You know, from a technical side, when it comes to the rescue, or like if you're on a team that responds, or like a USAR team or whatever, there's going to be engineers and folks that are going to be there that give you a lot of information that you just don't have at your fingertips as a first arriving company when we're talking about this. But most of the time, these construction companies or these big places that are being built, especially if it's a larger development, or a larger building, a lot of times they'll have expertise on site, and that's where you start asking for, you know, the representatives. And, you know, in reality, part of what you're doing at that point in time is beginning to develop and implement a unified command to where you're utilizing the expertise that exists there as a consulting component to fire ground operations, and people don't think about that. But from a command perspective, that's one of the first things that I want at the command post is somebody that truly understands that site, knows what's going on, so that they can start feeding information to us as we begin building that. The next thing that I want to throw out about construction site emergencies is a lot like hazardous materials incidents. They're not instant gratification, and most fire service individuals are the folks that like instant gratification from their actions. In other words, we stretch a hose line, we make entry into a building that has, you know, fire that is, you know, out of control at that point, and we begin fire suppression tactics, you know, between water flow application, between, you know, air current movements and ventilation and flow paths and all that type of stuff. You know, same thing goes on these type of incidents is, you know, you have certain things that are going, but most of the time in fire suppression, it's a lot faster than in technical rescue or in hazmat. And that's something that most people don't realize is when we're talking about the trenching components to this is the amount of hazmat that you could be getting into or the hazardous energy. So, again, when we start talking about this, you know, there's a lot of things that go into the OSHA standards that are related to industry, but there's also the components that wrap over to us general duty clause that's going to be applicable to our NFPA standards and looking at that stuff. And we're not remiss from hazardous energy control in the fire service. It's a requirement that we, you know, have policies and procedures and the ability to facilitate this stuff for the safety of our people. So let's talk a little bit about that hazardous energy control that exists, you know, on these construction sites. And specifically, you did mention the utilities that are coming in a lot of these trenches, but, you know, all the other aspects that are associated with equipment and things that, you know, exist that may be operational in trenches or in and around trenches that we got to worry about.
Yeah, Doug, you know, I'll start with the first point. You kind of talked about the equipment that's in and around a trench. You know, how many firefighters are going to jump up inside of a large excavator or a dozer that's sitting next to a trench and it's running and feel comfortable enough to actually, you know, make it safe, get it shut down. And you talk about referencing the individuals from the companies themselves, you know, in kind of a unified command, which is a phenomenal idea. And I think that's the reason why one of my big focuses is I'm trying to reach out beyond the fire service. I want us to be better. That's my job, and it's kind of a philosophy I live by, and I know a lot of other people may use it too, but my job is to make everybody around me better than me, and that's what this is all about, which is great. But guess what? I've got to make these construction site people better as well, because I want those relationships to be there so that when we show up, it is a more fluid movement. Because let's face it, who are the subject matter experts when it comes to construction? Well, they are. That's the reason why they're doing it. Our job is to perform services to make something better. But we talk about, you know, they're going to make this big, large equipment safe. That may not be a possibility with our people on there. You may be working with a construction, you know, with a construction crew that's very limited. If you've got two or three people, do you think one of those people are going to break away to go shut off a piece of equipment when one of their best friends or brother-in-law or something like that is actually trapped somewhere? It's going to be very unlikely. But moving on to some of that hazardous energy, that's all around us. That's in everything we do. That's not even at the construction sites. But let's face it, so most of the times at the construction sites, it's not nearly as marked because you're in the process of building something. So, yes, there may be power to a building, but how are we going to know how to isolate that? And does our, you know, do our fire crews have the ability or the education to isolate that energy? It's something that goes deep, and you've done a great job referencing OSHA several times. And of course, on my safety side, that is, you know, it's kind of the Bible. But when you take it over to the fire side, there's a lot of individuals in the fire service that kind of feel like we're above that. And you brought up that general duty clause, which is literally the catch-all. That's the one that if you're not following something else, if you're not following an NFPA, if you're not following NIOSH, if you're not following ANSI, if you're not following those things, that's where that general duty clause is. And, I mean, I implore people to jump on Google and just look up fire departments fined by OSHA, and you'll find hundreds of them. It happens all the time. But just kind of bouncing back to the hazardous energy, we as fire service personnel rely a lot on water, and we all know that water and that electricity does not mix well together. So isolating those kind of things at a construction site can be much harder than walking into a structure or to a residential home and pulling a meter or shutting everything off at a main. Those things are fairly easy for us. Those are things that are fairly routine because that's what we do. But when it comes to energy in a construction site, it could be high energy, much higher than you're used to dealing with, because it is a commercial site. Is somebody from the crew, are you going to feel comfortable making that decision? Or once again, are we referring to the individuals there at the construction site that physically know that? Or if there's no one at the construction site, what type of resource do we have in the fire service to call that, you know, to reach out to help us, you know, improve the situation that we're faced with?
You know, the thought process comes in the mind is when I say we're an all-hazards mitigation response unit anymore, and we talk about mutual aid in the fire service, but, you know, one of the things that we depend upon quite frequently is not only just the construction site people, but also our power companies or our gas companies, you know, those type of people to respond to us, to assist us. And it's, you know, it's commonplace in the world that I live in that we call, you know, the power companies to come in and, you know, do hazard mitigation for us. You know, we can do some control of things, but if you really want to control it, you go back to a point where it's the technical ability of what we have versus what they have and their expertise. That's where you go back to really make it safe. And that's where working relationships and collaborations among groups of people is so critical. And, you know, we've kind of hit that pretty good, but I want to move on just a little bit to the next thing that kind of sticks out in my mind is we're kind of coming out of the ground. We're beginning to get things started or built here, and then all of a sudden we have these pieces of the puzzle that start falling together with the construction that create confined spaces that may not exist after the building's built, but it actually are part of the building process. So, you know, Mike, as you've seen many of these buildings built, you're a part of that on an everyday basis. Let's look at exactly what type of confined spaces we get faced with on most of our construction projects.
Doug, one of the big things, you know, you said once we come out of the ground, but honestly, one of my biggest risks for confined spaces is when my guys are done laying pipe. Once they've got the pipe in the ground, they've set structures, they've got to tile that pipe into it, they've set risers for manholes. They have to go back in and they have to seal all of that stuff, whether it's with concrete or some type of sealer. So that's where my confined space stuff starts. Having that many employees, my air monitoring cachet is fairly large. I keep I have about 50 crews, and with those 50 crews, I keep somewhere around 48 air monitors that those guys have to use, and not only their confined space stuff, but also in their trenching anytime they're over 4 feet. So atmospheric monitoring for that is the guys are pretty versed in. But yeah, the confined space starts there. But of course, when we start getting into buildings, you start putting in elevator shafts and you start putting in stairwells, and you start, before you start adding all of your drywall and everything to the walls, we are going to have some areas where it's definitely going to be a lot more confined than others. And as I said before, I can always refer to the company that I work for and kind of the steps that we've taken to help to protect the employees, which are extremely important, because if I can educate them and help protect them, that makes them less likely to have to be calling 911. But I can't speak for everybody else, and I know for a fact throughout prior to working for the construction company, I worked for an industrial safety consulting firm, and I traveled the U.S. and I worked at different companies, and I saw some of the places that that maybe they didn't take that stuff as serious. So they weren't versed on confined spaces, and how many people enter a confined space that really don't even know that it meets the criteria of a confined space. And so it puts them in a bad position because it allows them to get someplace they don't need to be. And then on top of that puts us in a position to where we're having to, you know, to respond to that. And once again, I think one of the biggest topics that we have that once we hit on all of these is the organization that we belong to. Are we prepared? Not only in our minds, but, you know, the equipment. And for some of this stuff, you know how just absolutely cost prohibitive it is to have some of that stuff short of coming across grants and so on and so forth. But confined space, once again, is a daily activity. If you're in a community where you have a public works department, I guarantee you it's 5 out of 6 days there's probably somebody that's somewhere near a confined space. Power generation plants was something big that I did, and that place is chock full of confined spaces. And while they know them well, do we? You know, are we out doing some we pre-plan buildings pretty well in most cases. But are we identifying confined spaces? And also during that construction phase, have they been identified at all? I mean, that's usually something that happens towards the latter part of someone actually taking possession of that building.
Well, you hit on something that really I want to drive home to our listeners is during the building phase, even these stairwells and elevator shafts and those type of places don't have the proper ventilation that's going to be in place once you have HVAC systems in to actually move air through these, you know, areas to keep them, you know, into a atmospheric condition that is, you know, conducive for humans to be in. So even if we're in a process of building a stairwell or we have an elevator shaft, that is actually a confined space that a lot of times people won't think about. Oh, it's a big open air thing, you know, that we can move through, and we're just putting a ladder up, or we're just dropping somebody in. But again, those become confined spaces because there's not all the other systems that are in place that provide for the safety of the atmosphere and those type of things that, you know, happen after the building is already built or is being occupied. But these are areas to get into, and that's one of the things that I wanted to throw out. And you hit on going back in and tying piping and utilities and things together. But I want to hit on the not so obvious, which were the stairwells and the elevator shafts and some of these even below grade rooms to where air currents are not moving in there simply because there's not HVAC. And, you know, it's real easy for us to come in and have a what I will call an ignorant approach just because we don't have the knowledge and we're not educated in some of this. So your whole focus of this program that you put together, the whole focus of tonight's show is about getting information to people so that they are educated and we're not going in blind to our first two companies that are out in the streets. And, you know, that's one of the pieces. And air quality monitoring is not something that is typical on an engine company rolling in. It's probably more associated to a specialty piece someplace. But, you know, again, I go back to this is not instant gratification. This is more of a very methodical, slow, thought-out process of having all your facts, you know, into play before you, you know, start reacting, you know, in a knee-jerk fashion. You need to, you know, have all the facts that, you know, are going to allow you to make strong tactical decisions that are safe and fit into a good operational scheme. Now, we've talked about trenches. We've talked about some confined space. Let's bring, you know, this building, you know, to the point that now we have somebody down in some of these pits that may not be a confined space or may not be a trench, but we have to get them out or we have to go in to get them because of a fall or something associated to that with injury. And what does it take to do that? And again, some of that actually does drop back to, do we need to be safe and monitor the air? You know, what type of rigging system are you going to use? You know, how safe is it for us to set some of the equipment up? You know, that type of stuff. So, Mike, hit on that a little bit.
Yeah, sure thing. So you bring up a great point. You know, firefighters are pretty MacGyver-like. I mean, let's face it. There's a lot of times where they'll be put in a situation and they'll come up with a plan that you didn't see in any, you know, any ifs to book or reading a fire engineering magazine or looking online or listening to even the podcast. It's not something that really gets talked about. There are some times and there are some scenarios that you really look at it and as a collective team, you come up with how can we do this? And the two things that I'll talk about is, yeah, with somebody inside of a building and being able to be rescued out, there's several things to take into consideration. And the atmosphere monitoring by far is one of the ones. That's one of the things that I think in the fire shelter we lack a little bit that we could, you know, we could definitely improve upon. But what equipment do we have already? Like I said, I dealt with a lot of these power generation plants, and the closest technical rescue response of any type was hour, 2 hours away. And does that mean that we, as that first an engine company or truck company or, you know, a small department, are we just going to sit there and wait for their arrival? Well, that's not how we're geared. So there's plenty of things that we can do with the usage of ladders, with the usage of our rope systems. Not to mention, once again, we refer back to the construction companies that are there. Believe me, they have stuff around there that can help us out. They may have their own, you know, tripod setups and things like that can help, you know, with a little bit of mechanical advantage to get people out of those kind of spaces. But one of the other things we talk about making that rescue from and while the building's going up is there's going to be a ton of aerial lifts that are going to be utilized. There's going to be a ton of scaffolding that's going to be utilized. And sometimes those things fail. And one of the biggest points that I try to get across very early in the course is, you know, it's great that you have your truck company, right? And you got your 100-foot, 105-foot, whatever 107-foot, you know, aerial that you're going to use, you know, hey, and you're thinking about this construction site, and you're like, hey, one of those guys in that basket, you know, he gets, you know, goes unconscious or something happens to the actual aerial lift or something happens to one of those people on that, they have a partial, you know, collapse of the scaffolding. You know, we're just going to roll right up in there. We'll take that ladder and we'll sit it up there. Well, the problem with that is if you've ever looked at a construction site, the majority of the time the road is the last thing they do. So access becomes a huge issue. Maybe some of your ground ladders don't make it. So once again, it's putting a thought process in our mind early, and just basics. As I said, you know, previously, I'm not talking to the technically trained person, the ones that are sitting through these courses for hours on end to learn how to be better at their craft. This is really for the firefighters that are just getting started, the company officers that are just getting started, and trying to educate them on some basics that make them safe, as well as give them things they can do because they know. And so access becomes a huge issue at construction sites. You're not going to be able to just roll that rig right up next to a building. And that doesn't matter what's going on around there, because whether it's, let's face it, whether it's supplies that's set around buildings, whether that's, you know, the conditions of the roadway around. I know you were talking about getting some rain today. I know we got some this morning, which rained out several of my job sites. But it doesn't take much for a job site to, I mean, it's hard to navigate an excavator on tracks, you know, around these places. So access becomes a huge issue for us. But yeah, being those first arriving companies, you know, your equipment may be fairly limited to be able to go in and actually physically get someone out of an area, especially once we have part of that building around them.
You know, you bring up access points, and that's something a lot of people don't think about. And this is another piece of the puzzle, too, is, you know, the movement of equipment from wherever you may have to move your equipment from to actually the work site is a very labor-intensive process. I can remember on one particular scene, and of course I worked on a technical rescue group that responded to this, but the initial operations, just to get set up, we were having to carry equipment, you know, an astronomical distance. And that begins to tie into, you know, the fatigue factors that exist with the heat or with the cold, with the, you know, the weight of the equipment you've got to move. So, you know, that's something that is critical in the sizing up of an incident. And, you know, most of our folks, when they're first due, they think they got to do something. And, again, I go back to my instant gratification component. A lot of what you're going to be doing as a first arriving engine company to one of these construction site emergencies is you're the recon unit. You're the one that is getting, you know, the intel that exists, looking at the situation as a whole, beginning to disperse information back as to what we're going to need, what you're seeing, and allowing, you know, somebody to help, you know, from the backside make decisions, but also for crews that may be the group that's coming in that's technical rescue, begin formulating some of their plans. And, you know, unfortunately, there's not as much, you know, in the way of, you know, teaching people this as there should be. And, you know, that's kind of what I look at your program here is to help folks to be able to size things up a little better and to move forward. So if you would, Mike, hit on some of the big size-up features that I know you talk about in your program that first due companies or these structural companies that are rolling into these construction sites and emergencies, what are some of the things they should be looking at in their size-up?
One of the big things is something I actually handed out in my class from FDIC, which I thought was taken. It turned out really well. It was really a pre-planned sheet for construction sites. And it's really meant for you to go there and talk to, whether it's a construction manager or maybe you reach out and you're able to speak to their safety professional. But it's about doing some size-up things before there's ever anything that happens. You know, for instance, we've all seen these construction sites, large apartment complexes, things like that, burning from end to end, top to bottom, right? Let's face it, that's a fire. We got that one down pretty quick. We're not, you know, we say we're not making rescues, right? But the back side of that is, are we sure there's no rescues? You know, if it's after hours, sure, we don't think there's any construction site people there, but are there any individuals that have made it onto a job site that needed a place to stay for the evening? You know, there's a lot of things that play into that, especially when you're talking about that initial size up. So while there's a fire, that's great, okay? So now, first off, we talked about our access issues. And so as far as your size up goes, access issues are one thing. But how about your closest water source? And is your closest water source even live yet because they just laid the new lines? And how does your community, whatever water service you may have, how do they signify that a hydrant is live or not live? I know here in the Metro Louisville area, if it's a construction site or one that the new ones that are being put in, they actually put them on facing away from the roadway or facing away from where you would access them, and that signifies to us that they are not live yet, which I think is a great size up. You know, where's my closest water if it's a fire? Secondly is, you know, typically a lot of construction sites have very limited access. So you may have one construction entrance, or you may have one or two construction entrances. The good thing is a lot of the construction fencing can be, you know, relocated somewhat easily, as long as it's, you know, it's not set, you know, in the ground. So access, you know, where's my closest water? But some of the things that this pre-planned sheet did was it kind of was a step-by-step to go down and, hey, you're going to be doing trenching. What's some of the deepest trenching you're going to be doing? Hey, you're going to have, is there going to be any confined space work? Hey, is there going to be any kind of work from height? And that size up is really going to tell you so much.
what you're getting into. There's different phases of the construction, you know, in construction. And so it's really, your size up can change from week to week, strictly because of the phase of the building that they're in. You know, have we set the first footer? Have we started going vertical with our building? And unfortunately, as we see in not only residential construction, but we're starting to see in even some commercial construction, buildings are getting taller. And unfortunately, some of them are being stick built or built with this new fabricated, the engineered wood and all of that stuff that's playing a role in our lives in the fire service. And it's unfortunate because, once again, if they've put a scan around that building, are you aware? Did you pay a lot of attention, you know, when you're just cruising through your district? So that's one of the educational points that I'm trying to get out to people is don't just drive by and say, oh, cool, we're getting a new apartment complex, or, oh, cool, we're getting a new building. You know, especially if you're a tax-based area and you're like, hey, more taxes, more money for a budget, which is wonderful. But we have to take the time to pay attention to those in each step. And we have to educate ourselves because that size up is truly going to be dictated by what phase of the construction business you're in. Doug, you still there, buddy?
You. I lost connection there for a minute.
I gotcha.
Some of the weather. Yeah, we're having weather problems too, so that falls in there. Sorry about that.
I thought I bored you to death.
No, the lightning going off and on. I had problems earlier too, so you cut out a little bit on my end, but I could hear you on the sound end, so that's good. But, you know, we've talked about a ton of things here for our listeners, and I was hoping we would get, you know, some folks, you know, that may have some questions to call in. Thus far, we've not had that. And, you know, I want to go back and just out of the top of your mind, just like you do in the program, let's highlight the biggest things that exist in your mind off of what would be the things that would jump out that would probably cause the most harm the fastest to our companies responding in?
The very first thing that, honestly, Doug, that I think about is because there is so much trenching that goes on at every job site, especially early in the construction phase, that is typically one of the first things that I would think cause our guys some harm, because once again, if you're not trained in that, then we're definitely going to have people that are going to run right up to an edge to see what's going on. Why? Once again, because we're wired to help. So I think the educational part of just giving you the basics, and I did it for a local fire department here they had a trench, had a call for a trench, had a young man that had a large dirt and rock clod roll off of a spoil pile that was about 8 feet from the edge, which was far further than required. rolled down into the trench while he was just trying to cap the end of a pipe so they could backfill for the day, and it broke his femur in four spots. It was very unfortunate, 22-year-old kid, and he endured a four-hour surgery just to regain the blood flow to the full parts of his leg. But when the fire department arrived, the EMS arrived, they wouldn't go anywhere near him because they didn't know if the trench was safe or not. Because here we are, we've got a gentleman laying in the bottom of the trench that's screaming bloody murder, and he's got a dirt clod laid against him. Is that going to happen to us? I wish I could share a picture with you, because literally this trench could have been on the front of a magazine. It was literally one of the nicest and cleanest dug trenches I'd seen in quite some time. But because they didn't know. So I did a class. It was called Dirt Basics. And that was really to educate them on what to look for. And that's one of those first hazards that I think we see, you know, in the construction side. And then secondly, I would really go into the utility side of things, the gas and the electric. We deal with gas leaks outside all the time because people dig into gas lines. And those are dangerous as it is. But the unfortunate thing is we respond to so many, it allows a lot of people to get into a complacent attitude and really, really makes it dangerous. But on a construction site, some of that stuff is not as clearly marked as it is, you know, because it hasn't gone through all of that process yet. Or maybe it hasn't been reburied yet and it's still exposed. So there's still a lot of things there as far as utilities go, even, you know, from gas to the electric side. Beyond that, the risk truly exists of, you know, structural stability of things during a construction process, you know, access issues during a construction process, and how does that construction site affect everything else around that site? You know, where are we putting this thing at? Is it in the middle of a busy, bustling area? Are there a lot of other people that are around? You know, that becomes that other hazard of people being curious. So you may have more than what you bargained for as far as individuals being in or around the construction site.
Well, you bring up good points. Tonight has been a great discussion that I hope our listeners are taking away a lot of points and a lot of thought processes to how they go about, you know, changing their philosophy, changing their thought process of just, you know, how complacent we can be and how diligent we must become in preparing for these type of emergencies. And it's not something that we probably run a bunch of in your districts a year. You know, we may run one or two, or we may get a couple here or there if you're a bigger department. But, you know, the potential, and that's the thing that I want to talk about, you know, here as we're closing out, is in the world of science, we talk about potential energy and kinetic energy. And, you know, the big thing that, you know, you look at is how much potential energy exists, or how much potential, quote-unquote, exists in having catastrophic events occur on these construction sites, or even the impact that it could have with the first two companies coming in that don't have the knowledge or don't have the, I guess, expertise, you know, to focus on this. And that's something that, you know, really sticks out to me is the conversation or a bigger conversation that we need to be having in our stations and at our kitchen tables as, you know, we're going about our daily business and being more diligent on focusing in on exactly what is going on around us. A lot of times we just, you know, take advantage of going past these sites and never even, you know, looking at them when we could stop and have a better vantage point to it. And, you know, we've talked a lot about that. We've talked about some things. And, you know, one of the things that I want to hit real quick here, just as we do close for a lot of potential. It's like we're experiencing, you know, some weather here now. You know, a lot of these construction sites, you know, operate year round. It's not something that goes away in the summertime because of the heat. It doesn't go away in the spring because of the rain. It doesn't go away in the wintertime because of the snow or the ice. So how much does weather really impact everything we're doing? It's like we're getting rain now and some thunder and some things like that that's going on. But, you know, let's think about this in a perspective of all four seasons. What do we see? What do we run into? And how does that change the dynamic as we start wrapping up the show here, Mike?
Yeah, sure thing, Doug. You know, the one thing you brought up a point earlier about making a response to a construction site and having to transport equipment from one side to the other. So we know that in the safety world, walking, working surfaces is a very, very big term. And that really has to do with, you know, the areas that you're walking in. So let's face it, that spring, when you get those downpours of those rain, yeah, it puts things behind, but it doesn't always stop work. So that changes our terrain quite a bit. So we talked about access issues before, but the spring you could definitely you'll definitely contend with it a lot more than you will throughout maybe a dry summer. The snow, once again, we're getting into areas where now how are they don't think that they won't be roofing in the winter, even when it snows, because I can promise you, I've watched many of these crews work in some pretty hairy situations to get a job done, and it's unfortunate because there's several things that play a role to that. Is the lack of knowledge, lack of training, or just a lack of caring in trying to get a job done, and I get it, but. The change of the seasons brings about, it takes those hazards that we have, and sometimes it'll magnify those and also make them much more challenging. So building those relationships with these construction sites and these construction companies in your areas, getting out in your district and really stretching your legs, and we can sit around the kitchen table and we can talk about it, which is a great start. But I implore you to get out. Go meet these construction sites, and towards the end of the class, I'll be more than happy to give an email if people want to reach out. I'll send them a pre-planned sheet, and I'll share that with anybody and everybody, because I truly feel like I have a subject that can help so many people, and that's really my focus.
Well, go ahead and give them that email now, Mike, so that people can reach out to you for you know, further assistance, further conversation, and especially for, you know, that pre-plan sheet.
Absolutely. You can email me at constructionsiteemergencies@gmail.com, and I will be more than happy to share anything that I have. Got some great relationships with companies like United Rentals in their trench safety division. They provide me with all kinds of handouts and things like that, and I can send that stuff out to give people, you know, something to keep in the visor, something to keep, you know, around their fire gear to help, you know, some reference, especially when it comes to trench safety. So I'd love to be able to help out anywhere I can.
Well, that's great, Mike. I definitely want to thank you for coming on the show. I want to thank you for your efforts that you're doing in the world of the fire service to heighten this awareness, to, you know, bring folks into a thought process that is maybe a little different than what they normally do. That's some great stuff. Great program at FDIC. I think that we're introducing folks to some things that they really don't think about on a daily basis, and that's critical in our success. So thank you for coming on the show. Any parting thoughts you want to disperse out, Mike?
Doug, thanks again for the opportunity. This was absolutely wonderful. Once again, as I'll be more than happy to help. I've already been reached out to from people to actually come out and deliver the class, and I'm looking forward to hopefully working some of that out. But if you need anything, construction site emergencies at gmail.com, reach out to me anytime. I'll get back with you as soon as possible. But sit around that table, start taking a better look at these construction sites that are in and around your district. You know, Doug, you brought up a good point earlier, said this may be something we may not see but once a year. But guess what? There's a lot of people that go around tying knots and setting up for high angle rescues, and some folks may not ever see them in their careers. So just because it's something that doesn't happen every single day doesn't mean that we can't prepare ourselves for it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Mike, thank you for coming on the show. To our listeners, I apologize for a little bit of a technical difficulty in there, having to switch phones in the call-in because of some weather issues. But nonetheless, we did as we always do in the fire service. We adapt, improvise, and overcome, and that's always good. It's good to be able to bring somebody on to fire and training that has a unique topic, and that is our goal with fire and training, is to provide the best information and training topics we can to our men and women who are out in the streets taking care of business every day. I want to thank my guest, Mike Wallingford, for coming on and you know, sharing some of his expertise. I want you to be thinking about what's to come in April as we get back together at FDIC and as the fire engineering family. And, you know, honestly, Mike said it best about going to FDIC. It was just amazing being out there. It was great being back together as groups of people, as education was being dispersed and disseminated out in Indianapolis, just a phenomenal experience of being back together and being what FDIC always is, you know, the Super Bowl of the fire service programs. And I want to thank Fire Engineering for, you know, the opportunity to have Fire and Training, Bobby Halton, all the staff at Fire Engineering that allow these things to go on. And again, I would be remiss if I didn't say that our goal of Fire and Training is to make sure that everyone goes home. To Mike, thank you for joining the show. To our listeners, I hope you enjoyed tonight's show. Something a little different, but definitely a topic that we need to explore. And I look forward to having you again on a show with Fire and Training in the near future. Till then, stay safe, train hard, and we'll see you on the next edition of Fire and Training. I'm your host, Douglas Klein, signing off. Till the next time, be safe.